This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn. I'm Chua Eun Teik. Alberto Gomez is Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at La Trobe University. He's also the Global Director of Dialogue, Empathic Engagement and Peace Building Network. He recently gave a talk about Malaysia's first peoples titled Materially Poor, Morally Rich at the Jeffrey Chia Institute on Southeast Asia. He's joining me now on the line from Melbourne, where he's based, to talk about that paper. Professor, I wanted to begin in terms of the language used, because I've seen many terms used interchangeably, and you prefer the term Orang Asli and First Peoples in English. What is the right word for us to be using?
Right. The word Orang Asli is, the name Orang Asli is something that's now accepted by the people themselves. It is indeed an exonym. It's a name that has been given to them. And now Orang Asli have begun to accept it and adopt it as what we would refer to as an autonym. It's a name that they refer to themselves. Now, within those groups itself, there are a number of names that we continue to use to refer to certain groups, subgroups of Orang Asli, that, you know, I have suggested that we should, you know, consider using the sort of proper names that, you know, people, names that people are accepting of. So, for example, we still use the ethnic label Negrito, which in, you know, it's a Spanish borrowed, you know, term that refers to short people or, you know, people with negroid, you know, features. And I think this is really problematic to refer to one group of Malaysian Aboriginal people. Yes, they do have certain features that anthropologists would describe as negroid, you know, wavy hair or short, crinkly hair. But I think the problem here is that we ought not to use a racial term of this sort to refer to a group of Malaysian Aboriginal people. Now, the people themselves refer to you know, they use the autonym Munrak, which in their language, in Jahai, for example, it means people. And so they refer to themselves in a way that is kind of very inclusive and very broad. But in their language, it means human.
You used the word Aboriginal just now, and I've also seen words like Indigenous rights or the Native people use.
Yes.
What about in English? What's the right word to use?
Well, whatever word you use, you know, it really depends on what meanings that are attached to that word. So take Australia, for example. The first peoples of Australia are referred to as Australian Aboriginal people. Now, the word Aborigines has been accepted by, you know, Australian Aboriginal people. But however, there are certain kinds of sort of shortened versions of the word that are considered to be invidious or they're considered to be derogatory when used. For example, in the Australian context, one would not refer to them as Ebos, which, you know, tends to go back to the days where they were strongly discriminated. They still are, but, you know, things have improved a little. Now, the global concepts that is acceptable today by most indigenous peoples is the word indigenous. And once again, you know, not all groups of people have embraced or have adopted that term itself in reference to themselves. So there are a number of different words that are being used. For example, in India, they would use the term Adivasi, which means people who have come first. And so, you know, it really refers to, in English, the first peoples. So whatever term that we use in reference to such groups of people, I think can be problematic or will become problematic or will also become unacceptable by the various people if we do not change the various meanings that are attached to those terms. So in the Malaysian context, for example, when we use the word Orang Asli, it may appear to be acceptable. But in the minds of a lot of Malaysians, I would, you know, guess that when we utter the words Orang Asli, what they do have are the images of people who are backward, primitive, or, you know, people were considered to be, in many ways inferior to the other Malaysians. And I think we need to change those negative stereotypical images that are associated with terms like that. Now, it is really important for us then to sort of reevaluate all those concepts that we use in reference to such groups of people. But this reevaluation would require a much greater respect and much greater sort of positive image, you know, attached to those terms. So it's not really what word that we use or what ethnic labels that we adopt in reference to such groups of people. The point I want to make is, what do these various labels mean? And if they continue to mean the kinds of negative impressions that we have, then, you know, whatever word we use, it's going to carry those images. So I think it's really important that we begin to challenge those kinds of negative stereotypical images that are associated with the names that have been adopted in reference to such groups of people.
So the title of your presentation, Materially Poor, Morally Rich, I'm guessing it's a play on the phrase "land rich, dirt poor," which describes many of the failed policies towards indigenous communities around the world, despite their government's best intention. Would that be a fair characterization?
Yes, indeed. I was actually trying, in the title of my paper, trying to make a distinction between, you know, the material and the moral, in the sense that we tend to focus a great deal when we speak about poverty, for example. We tend to focus on the material aspects of poverty. But, for example, there are lots of people who have got lots of money and have lots of wealth and wealth objects, and they've got cars and houses and whatever, you know, various sorts of standards that we have used to measure wealth may actually be morally poor. And I think this is where the point I was trying to make is that in our eyes, you know, when we look at Malaysian Aboriginal people, they don't have much possessions. Comparatively, they may seem to be somewhat materially poor. But the talk that I gave, I wanted to stress the fact that, yes, they do not have all these possessions that we take for granted. Yes, they do not have several televisions that we do have in our own homes. And also the fact that they may not have cars, and they may not have all these kinds of material objects that we have used to associate with wealth. But what they do have, which I think we are in many ways, modern society has been quite impoverished, the sort of very strong moral values that relate to, and in my talk, I focus on a number of them, that relate to non-violence, for example. They relate to the way they respond to one another, their interpersonal relations, which is one of mutual respect, non-aggression, you know, being humble, inclusive, egalitarian, and being generous. And also the various sorts of values that they have, which makes them morally rich. I mentioned non-violence, but I would also like to mention, their kinds of ecological values that they have, the value of being cooperative. And most importantly, one of the values that seems to be a value that is in many ways, upheld by all the Malaysian Aboriginal groups, and that's peaceability. The ability that they have to live in peace with one another and to kind of create the various conditions that are necessary for peacefulness. And I think this is a value that we can learn, and that's why I consider that these are sorts of moral values, you know, moral sorts of norms that such groups of people have, that in modern society we have been impoverished, you know, because we have driven ourselves to chase, for example, the dollar. We have been driven in a kind of a heightened consumerist society to, you know, chase objects. And in the process, you know, we seem to have lost some of the fundamental moral values which Malaysian Aboriginal people still do hold on to.
Just to play devil's advocate here,
Sure.
Is this not an overgeneralization which plays to this fraught and romanticized stereotype of the happy poor man, or that the orang asli are nature's best conservationists?
Indeed. I'm often,
yeah, because
there are lots of people who
because they're just human, right? Like you and me, subject to, you know, the same sins and egos and greed.
Yes, I mean, this is the reference to the people of the indigenous peoples as the noble savage, and I mean it goes back to the debates of Rousseau and Hobbes as to modern life and Rousseau. Pointing out the fact that the romanticized picture that he or image of the of what has been referred to as a noble savage. Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm not in any way suggesting that all indigenous peoples or all orang asli do subscribe to the various norms and values that I've spoken about. But one also needs to take into consideration that orang asli who no longer abide by these various sorts of principles or values are very much those orang asli who have had to come to terms the various sorts of damaging effects of their encounters with the modern world. In other words, they are unable to, for example, they're unable to maintain a very close connection with nature, precisely because they have been taken away from, displaced from their lands. And as a result, they're unable to have that sort of connection that one would expect them to have. So yes, you're right that by painting this image or painting this picture of the indigenous peoples, I can be, certainly accused of being a romanticist. But however, I also believe very strongly that I think we probably need to look at some of these various sorts of norms and values which have been regarded as romanticist as a way of challenging the kinds of very nasty, brutal sort of kind of thinking that exist among many humans today. So at times, perhaps we have to look at ways of how we can challenge, say, rising bigotry, challenge racism, inequality, the alienation that we find in the world today, and whatever label that you might use in terms of the kinds of practices that certain indigenous peoples have. And these are, clearly, you're absolutely right. They come across as being very romantic. But the point here is that you also need to keep in mind that one person's exotic, life could be someone else's very familiar. And this is where what orang asli might actually consider, or orang asli might actually look at the outside world and consider that world to be exotic, because it's something that they have been taught to feel that competition is good, that you have to accumulate as much as you can, and so this may seem to be kinds of values that have been imparted to orang asli, and that could be seen as somewhat exotic to them because it is unfamiliar. So, yes, I would take your devil's advocate point of view and agree that, yes, I'm being romanticist about this, but I think it's also important that, we have to hold on to certain kinds of values, irrespective of however we label them, in order to make the very necessary changes in the way we relate to one another and we relate to the environment.
I'm speaking today to Alberto Gomez, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at La Trobe University. After a short break, I'll ask Professor Gomez about state interventions in the Orang Asli's way of life and the limits of political representation for minority communities. BFM 89.9. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Entek. My guest today is Alberto Gomez, an Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at La Trobe University. He's speaking to me on the line from Melbourne about a talk he recently gave on Malaysia's First Peoples. The paper is titled Materially Poor, Morally Rich. You alluded to the fact that this perception of the Orang Asli as primitive or backward is very misguided, and how for them, working for cash might be something that is completely foreign to their culture. This other assumption that I think a lot of people have of the Orang Asli is that they are marginalized, or a lot of them live in hardcore poverty according to how we measure wealth and well-being. It's because they choose to be that way and they want to be on the fringe of society. Is that correct?
Well, no. I would think that that is not correct for a number of reasons. One is that Orang Asli are not isolated or remote people. They have interacted with the outside world, if you want to put it that way, for generations. If you look at the forest trading, and if you go back to the maritime trade of, you know, from the first century AD, a lot of the products that were traded that spent a good part of 15 centuries and, in fact, had involved a number of different cultures right across from China, Malay Peninsula, and, you know, right across to the Middle East. And in that trade, you know, from China, India, the Middle East, you find that a lot of the products that were traded were forest products. Now, Orang Asli were the only people who had extensive knowledge of such kinds of products. So they must have been involved in the trading of such products, you know, that goes back to, in historical record, that goes back to the first century. So to argue that they are isolated and remote, it flies against the face of that kind of historical record. That's one. Now, secondly, is that when we speak about the choice that Orang Asli have made in terms of wanting to live remotely or live in, you know, in the forest, for example, in the deep forest, it was not so much of a choice, but it was a necessity, because Orang Asli, for a good part of around the 14th, 15th, and particularly at the heights of the 16th and 17th century, Orang Asli were the targets or the victims of slave raiding. There were, you know, number of stories that Orang Asli tell of how they have been captured as slaves. And in fact, there are several very interesting papers that have been written on this, on the effects of slave raiding on the Orang Asli. Now, with the movement of people, especially from Indonesia and settled along the coast of Peninsula Malaysia, Orang Asli were considered to be backward people because they lived in the upper reaches of the rivers. And in the process, they were pushed into the hinterland. So this notion of them living, you know, away from the centers, economic centers, is really one where they were actually displaced from the centers. Now, let me give you an example where the headquarters of Bang Bun Putra, I think it's still there, right in the center of Kuala Lumpur, what used to be called the Malacca bus station, which is very close to where Kuala Lumpur gets its name, the confluence of the two rivers. You know, that was a settlement there was an Orang Asli settlement right at that confluence of Kuala Lumpur. And they were driven away. They were pushed away into the interior. So they may have moved out into places like Ulu Langat. Subsequently, with the development of those areas, they were pushed even further interior. And so Orang Asli have always been displaced. They've been pushed from the so-called centers into the periphery. Now, the third point I want to make about this is that this concept of marginalization. Now, often we think of marginalization as, you know, people who live on the margins or where the centers are located or in the periphery. But however, when you use it in a sociological sense, marginalization takes place when a dominant group of people move into an area, and in the process of the relations of domination and subjugation, they tend to dominate over a group of people who then become marginalized. So the concept of marginalization here refers to power differentials. So orang asli, so the question here is that if there were no other Malaysians, the orang asli would not have been marginalized. They would actually been the people who lived in those areas. Take, for example, Australia. If it was not for the coming of the whites to this continent in Australia, then the marginalization of the Australian Aboriginal people would not have occurred. So marginalization has taken place primarily because of the relations that such groups of people have had with dominant others. So in other words, you know, marginalization, it's not due to the isolation or due to the remoteness of the group of people, but largely due to the increasing relations that such groups of people have had, such less dominant groups of people have had with people who are more dominant. So marginalization here refers to the increase in poverty, the impoverishment of such groups of people through various ways of displacement, dispossession, discrimination, and, you know, the various kinds of degradation of those environments that such people have lived. And that's the cause of the marginalization. So with all those three factors, what I'm trying to argue is that orang asli have become marginalized primarily because of increased contact that they've had with a more dominant group of people.
So knowing all this, what is the state's responsibility towards the orang asli in terms of education, health, and the like? Because, correct me if I'm wrong, is it not the position of the orang asli to have as little intervention or interference as possible in their way of life?
Yes, I think there's absolutely no choice. If you are in this modern world, then, you know, you have to interact with the rest of the world. You cannot live isolated from any group of from the others, whichever, you know, country that you live in. Orang asli are conscious of that. They know, and they've always been people who have interacted with non-orang asli, as I mentioned early on, and, you know, but there are several, you know, issues here. One is that there has to be much greater recognition of who the people are. There also has to be much greater recognition of the fact that they are indeed, you know, Malaysia's first peoples. In the past, several Malaysian leaders have, you know, argued that, you know, orang asli cannot claim such a position of indigeneity because they did not have a state system, or they were considered to be, you know, people who did not have a very advanced society. This is totally erroneous, and that has to be challenge, and that has to be rectified. So first is to do with recognition of the orang asli. Number two, there also has to be a much greater sense of respect for the orang asli. We have to challenge all the negative views that people have, the stereotypical images that people hold of the orang asli, and that needs to be not just challenged, it also has to be discarded. And I think it's really important that the average Malaysian would need to have much greater respect for the orang asli. You don't need anthropologists like me all the time sort of saying that, you know, you have to have respect for the orang asli. I think it's really important for Malaysians to go out there, meet with orang asli, and be more empathic and compassionate and learn about, you know, orang asli. If you ask the average Malaysian how much do they know about orang asli, and you'll find that very few actually do know. And they often would make remarks as, oh yes, you know, I met a few orang asli when I was going up towards Cameron Highlands, and I bought some durian from them. But how much do you know about their culture? So this is something that where respect is related to. The third is we have to make sure that all the kinds of injustices that Orang Asli face at the moment are removed. Okay, so for example, they sometimes, you know, state officials will say, oh, you know, we have been giving Orang Asli land, not recognizing the fact that in the first place, the land has been taken from the Orang Asli. And so now you feel that you are being kind of, you know, benevolent and you're giving out land to the Orang Asli. No, you are actually returning. And not all of the land, because a lot of the Orang Asli have been displaced from their land and they have not been sufficiently compensated. So that's an important issue. At the moment, we find when we speak about injustices, if you were to talk to various activists, both Orang Asli and non-Orang Asli, who have been involved in Orang Asli activism, and you find that right around the peninsula, as we speak, you know, we find that there are so many Orang Asli communities where, you know, people have been evicted, logging has come in and destroyed their land, and Orang Asli have had blockades against such you know, logging activity. And we have a number of Malaysians who have stood very you know, prominently in support of such Orang Asli groups of people. So that kind of injustice that Orang Asli have to face on a very regular basis has to be stopped. Now, I think the other thing too is that the Orang Asli don't really matter to a lot of politicians and to the state because they are numerically very small. They don't matter at the ballot box because, you know, the Orang Asli might cast their votes, but the votes would be quite insignificant as far as taking, you know, various politicians across the line to victory. But however, you have to keep in mind that Orang Asli are important to Malaysia. One is just as the way Australians are beginning to embrace the importance of Australian Aboriginal people. Because once we begin to come to terms to recognize such groups of people, and not just that, I think the important thing that one also needs to do is to come up with a process of reconciliation. Orang Asli have been treated very poorly. There have been, as I mentioned, you know, the number of different sorts of problems that they have to face. They've been treated very poorly. They have been looked down. They are, you know, impoverished. They have been taken away from their land. Their values, their own cultures have been downgraded. Their own cultures are considered to be, you know, considered to be very backward. And all that is something that all of us are implicated in if we have, you know, anything to do with Malaysia. And I think it's really important that we reconcile and that we try in many ways to make amends for all the wrongdoings that have occurred in the past. And so this is one of the things that, you know, we are doing at the moment. For example, I'm, you know, involved in assisting an Orang Asli organization called Kedrak. And Kedrak is mostly based in Perak at the moment, but it's slowly expanding to include Orang Asli from other parts of Malaysia. And Kedrak, they don't have much contributions. I mean, people don't contribute. And I've started something like a fundraising campaign, not just to raise money, because Orang Asli feel that it's not just money that they want, but you know, to support their campaigns or to support their various sorts of educational workshops. But what they want would be you know, contributions in terms of if you are a lawyer, for example, and you know, you can contribute some of the skills that you have to assist them in terms of their legal you know, in their various sort of legal struggles. If you are an accountant, for example, you can help them with auditing. And, you know, if you have any kinds of skills or talents, you can contribute that to the Orang Asli organization, like the Kandra. So sometimes I think we have to, in many ways, you know, we have to respect them, to recognize them, to reconcile the kinds of problems, you know, that we have caused towards them. And finally, I think we have to support them. But when I mean support, I don't mean help. And I think this is where some Malaysians have totally misconstrued. They felt, you know, I often in Malaysia, I get someone coming to me and saying, oh, you know, my church has organized a trip to the Orang Asli village. And we went there and we picked up the Orang Asli and we drove them and we gave them a very nice meal. That's really nice. You know, it's a nice thing to do to the Orang Asli. But start to, you know, examine your agenda and examine your intentions. Have you done this because, you know, you're doing it as part of a way of trying to convert the Orang Asli to Christianity? Are you doing this, you know, because you really care about the Orang Asli, which I hope you do? But I think more importantly, you have to go in there with your eyes open and, you know, with your hearts open, and most importantly, with your mind open to and open for a much greater understanding and knowledge of the Malaysian Aboriginal people, the Orang Asli.
You've dedicated your career to this. How did your interest in this field begin?
Well, you know, when I was growing up, my father was a Western classical musician, and he used to, you know, during the time of the silent movie era, he used to go up from Kuala Lumpur to Ipoh and play in those cinemas. You know, those time of the silent movie, you know, you had to play the piano in order to follow the various figures, that, you know, Charlie Chaplin and all those. So my dad used to stop on his way up at rest along the road, and he, you know, he met Orang Asli along the way. And of course, they were very shy and they would hide in the forest. And my father was intrigued by these people. He was fascinated by the Orang Asli. And he used to tell me as a young boy stories about his various meetings with such groups of people. And that got me interested in the Orang Asli. And my father wrote a jazz piece that was called Sakai Rhythm. I mean, Sakai is not a term that you use today. This was in the 1930s. And in his piece, it was an appreciation of the sounds of the forest, or what at those days was called the jungle. And it was also the appreciation of the sounds that the Malaysian Aboriginal people made to communicate with one another in the forest. So those were the sorts of stories that, you know, kindled this interest in me for the Malaysian Aboriginal people. Then I had the opportunity when I was in the university. There was a fairly young American anthropologist by the name of Terry Rambo, who had just left Vietnam after the fall of Saigon, or some might say the liberation of Saigon. And he arrived in Kuala Lumpur, you know, was at the University of Malaya. And I met Terry, and he was one of my lecturers. And he was interested as an anthropologist with the Orang Asli. And that's when I began to have a much more, I would say, an anthropological interest in the Orang Asli. So when I started my, I visited the Orang Asli for the first time in 1975. And I must admit that at that time, the only book that I read was by anthropologists in the 1920s, a person called Paul Schibester. The book was in German that was translated into English as Among the Forest Dwarfs. And for me, I had a very kind of romanticist perspective of the Orang Asli that I met. But that sense of, that exotic sense of romanticist sense disappeared very quickly when I, you know, witnessed the poverty, the hardship, you know, what the Orangasti had gone through, and the fact that they've been displaced, they had just been resettled from their, you know, homelands. And then I also observed, you know, the great happiness that they would have as soon as they went into their home territories, and the sadness that, you know, that befell on them when they had to return to those pattern villages. And it was then that started my interest in documenting the various problems that the Orangasli are facing, the impact of development. And when I did my master's, focused on that topic. And for a good part of my career as an academic, I have devoted my attention on sort of exposing all these kinds of developmental problems that the Orangasli were facing. And in my PhD research, I focused on the impact of the market economy on the Malaysian Aboriginal people, the impact of capitalism. And this is where, you know, my focus was very much about the Orangasti, and, you know, they were really, you know, critical work that exposed the kinds of problems that Orangasti are facing. And about 10 years ago, I started to take a different perspective as far as the Orangasti is concerned, because during the time that I spent with the Orangasti, when I go through all the notes, a lot of the notes that I have were actually about the wisdom of the people, about the wonderful, you know, practices, values, and, you know, norms. And I felt that perhaps I should devote my attention to writing about the, you know, the lessons that I've gained from the Orangasti. So ever since then, I've started, you know, publishing papers that focus on what it is that we can learn about the Orangasti rather than just about learning about the people. So learning from now, and it was learning about previously.
Professor Alberto Gomez, thank you very much for the work you do and for speaking to me today.
It's a great pleasure, and thank you for the opportunity to speak on a topic that's very dear to me, and not just a topic. It's, I think, it's a major political cause for me, and, you know, a career, and very much, you know, a lifelong, you know, ambition to get more people to, you know, appreciate the Orangasti and the opportunity that I've had and the pleasure I've had living with such great people.
I've been speaking to Alberto Gomez, an emeritus professor of anthropology at La Trobe University. He's also the global director of Dialogue, Empathic Engagement and Peace Building Network. You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.